Okay, so welcome to Multimedia Security. Last week, we started to look a little bit more closely into these requirements that we impose on the quality of a watermark. So these quality criteria are fidelity, robustness, security, and the payload. So fidelity means that we would like to have a watermark that is ideally invisible or at least visually unobtrusive. Robustness means that it is hard to remove. And then when you look at the papers, you will see oftentimes it's mixed with security because this removal can either be accidental, so that in all cases is robustness. But watermark removal can also be due to a targeted attack. And then in this case, one could say, okay, it's a case for security, like watermark security. Or one could say, yeah, okay, so if I say I'd like to have a robust watermark, that just means that includes robustness and security. Okay, and third is the payload. So how much information can I embed in a watermark, which might then be interesting, for example, to track specific customers or identify specific items using that watermark. All right, so I think we stopped somewhere in fidelity. Is that right or not? Okay, no one knows. Let's say we stopped in fidelity. So, really quick recap. So, in order to make sure that a watermark is visually unobtrusive, we said, okay, we have some embedding scheme, for example, an additive scheme where we create a watermark by adding a little bit, like some alpha, with some alpha weight, that watermark to every pixel. Yeah? Or we could also do that multiplicative or so. It doesn't really matter. So we could also say we perform a multiplicative scheme. That doesn't really matter. So in terms of fidelity, what is interesting is this alpha here, yeah, because it determines how strong the watermark is. And so the alpha determines the strength of the watermark. And this, of course, influences the parameters we're interested in, yeah, and particularly fidelity and robustness. So the idea now, okay, naive approach is, okay, let's just tune that alpha to our needs. But then in order to improve a little bit over that, what we can do is that we define alpha to be spatially variant and to adapt to the content of the image. So we can choose a larger alpha in regions where our eye would not notice any differences. And in regions where our perception is very sensitive, we tune that alpha down. And that way, we can embed in total more into the image at the same like fidelity. Yeah. So the idea is create a perceptual mask to locally adapt alpha. So therefore, we have an alpha I instead. Yeah, because it varies from pixel to pixel. and our overall equation then becomes something like, okay, I mean, that's a no-brainer, no? Yi equals xi plus alpha I times wi, something like this, for the additive case, for example. Yeah? Okay. And now the question is, what is a good perceptual mask? And a lot of masks have been proposed. You will deal with a minimum of two masks when you go through these papers. And all are a little bit heuristic, but influenced, of course, from results from psychology. And let me write down a couple of rules of thumbs, how to define a perceptual mask, yeah? How to define a perceptual mask. So some rules of thumb. We need a function that considers local contrast and so with the goal of determining regions with low contrast, because the eye is more sensitive there, and there we make the watermark weaker, in the other regions we make it stronger. Yeah. So eye or perception is more sensitive to low frequency regions or low contrast regions, yeah? So in these areas, we would like to tune down our alpha a little bit. And then the second thing is to our perception, luminance is more important than color. So these are two essentially pretty simple rules, yeah, which you could directly translate into a handcrafted function where you say, okay, so from rule number one, I deduce I should look for regions with a couple of edges in the image. So when there are edges, it's a good embedding area because our eye is not so sensitive to small changes because the picture is changing anyways. And then from the rule number two, we can say, okay, but let's look at what type of edges these are. are these color edges with constant luminance, so brightness, luminance is brightness, or are these brightness edges? If these are brightness edges, then maybe I'm not touching them so much. No? But I definitely would like to embed like crazy in color edges in the image. Yeah, and that would give a result that is relatively invisible to our perception. And you will see like there are all types of heuristics to essentially translate those two rules into actual algorithms. Okay, and remember last time we talked about the JPEG algorithm. Essentially, the JPEG algorithm does exactly that. Yeah, it cuts information where we are insensitive with our perception. Yeah, so it cuts the high frequencies and it subsamples on the color. And now here's an interesting thought. So if we had a perfect compression algorithm, so what constitutes a perfect compression algorithm, like in a theoretical sense? Yeah, one could say it maps all pictures that look the same to our eye onto one image. Yeah. Because we don't see any, like perceptually, they're all the same to us. So we can subsume all pictures that look identical to us as one picture. Yeah, that would be perfect compression in the sense that we only store what we can actually see. And in that case, if that would be the case, then we would not be able anymore to do any watermarking embeddings that are imperceptible. Because our compression algorithm would directly map it to that one super representative picture and it would be gone. Yeah. So that's interesting. So in a way we can say, what we also exploit here or what gives us great opportunities for embedding watermarks is that, for example, that JPEG algorithm that we have, it's just far from perfect. Yeah. It would not change much if we used another algorithm because actually there's no perfect compression algorithm. But JPEG in particular is a nice example. It's an old method. No? You can do way better than JPEG. So, and that means for watermarking people, okay, there's plenty of space in JPEG to put information in. Yeah, like watermark information, for example. Okay. Let's talk about robustness a little bit. I mean, all these topics are linked, but so generally, okay, we already got to know a couple of strategies how to achieve watermark robustness, yeah? Beyond adjusting the alpha. Of course, if we crank up alpha, things become very robust to accidental recoding or so, yeah? So one way that we had, so common strategies, let me put it like this, yeah? And these are all just applying common sense, essentially. Common strategies. So one thing is to do some redundant embedding, yeah? For example, in the second example method, we were replicating a shorter watermark a couple of times in in the whole image, yeah? But also the watermark length is, in a way, a form of redundancy. Yeah, if we just grant ourselves more bits to encode a watermark, we are also adding robustness, of course. Then, what we did up until now, or in the first worksheet of the exercises, was we embedded in spatial domain. Yeah, you can also say, maybe we will come back to that JPEG argument in a minute. Maybe it's better to actually embed in frequency domain and do something like spectral coding or spectral embedding, for example, spread spectrum. Coding. So spread spectrum coding is a concept that comes from military communications, assuming that someone like the opposing party can only jam so and so many frequencies at a time. The military built senders and receivers that were jumping from spectral band to spectral band, such that the communication as a whole could not be completely jammed. In our case, it's much simpler, you know. Like it's a militaristic phrase for actually a super no-brainer concept. The no-brainer concept is, so why should we embed our watermark into one spectral frequency if we can embed it in 10 spectral frequencies? And that's exactly what can be done. Okay, and then in order to have these fidelity requirements to also have some robustness towards JPEG compression, you can say, okay, it only makes sense to embed that watermark. For example, if you embed it in the discrete cosine transform that the JPEG algorithm uses, it only makes sense to embed it in the middle frequencies. Yeah? Because the very low frequencies are very visible, and the very high frequencies are cut off by JPEG anyways. So the only location that remains are the middle frequencies, if you're putting that in a JPEG algorithm. For example, the middle DCT coefs survive JPEG compression and are halfway imperceptible. Halfway imperceptible is probably not a clean definition, logic-wise, right? But that's okay, yeah. So that is like what we're doing in exercise number two, yeah? Okay, and then there are a number, I mean, in order to define robustness, we need to know like what are goals potentially against which we'd like to be robust, yeah? So common distortions that are interesting for these robustness considerations or evaluation goals. So common distortions that should be examined are additive noise, uh, And here's the theoretical result. So the linear correlator. If we have a watermarking scheme where the detector makes use of a linear correlator, that will work best in presence of additive noise. Is optimal. Then, of course, we could consider multiplicative noise, which is even introduced in the imaging process. So it's a very common, like additive and multiplicative noise are very common assumptions. So for multiplicative noise, normalized cross-correlation works best. We have that in our second watermarking scheme, like where we replicate these areas. Then, of course, we can have, and we can experience all types of linear filtering. Yeah, like someone is loading the image, thinks he or she is improving a little bit, and that might turn out actually to be an attack against our watermark, which is undesirable. So linear filtering, how can we evade that? So that is a little bit, that's a problem that is similar, has to be addressed in a similar way as we did it by choosing the middle DCT coefficients. Yeah, by choosing the middle DCT coefficients, we didn't do that in a very principled way. Yeah, we just said, high frequencies are bad, low frequencies are bad. What's left over? The middle frequencies. But actually, when you look at this problem at a more general, as a more general problem statement, what you can then do is that you look at the frequency response of the filter. So look at the frequency response of the filter, embed the watermark in those frequencies, that are least affected. So that is a complicated way of formalizing what we are doing here by just picking the middle DCT coefficients. Yeah. So let's revisit this decision for the middle DCT coefficients in the light of that statement. So we can say the JPEG compression is a filter that kills high frequencies. And we can say our human perception is a filter that makes low frequencies expensive to use. Yeah. And then by combining those two filters, like the only halfway acceptable filter response that we have left over is the middle one. Yeah. Okay. And that is where we put the watermark. Good. Yeah. JPEG, we talked about that. Quantization. Geometric distortions. These are bad. So that's probably the worst attack against a watermark, is some geometric distortion, because you desynchronize your picture, like your expected watermark with your picture. I need space. Some space somewhere. Just a little bit. So So intended to be below this point here, yeah, we have geometric distortions. Or sometimes called desynchronization. And that may not even be an attack. I mean, you can always do that as an attack to a watermark, yeah? But it can also accidentally happen, yeah? Someone loads an image and it's like, ah, it's a little bit too large, let me crop the boundaries. And then when you crop a little bit from the top and left, like the top left corner, then try to correlate your watermark with it, it does not correlate anymore, no? So it can't, no? And then there are essentially like two ways out here. I mean, okay, we always can do a brute force search, but that's not really practical. Or what we can also think about is embed additional like registration landmarks. So that means you need something that is also visually unobtrusive, but easy to find, in order to align your watermark detector with that picture, and then in order to detect that watermark. That may sound a little bit esoteric, but there are actually solutions to that, and there's a nice advertising video that I would like to show really quickly. So I'm not getting any money from that company, so it's just, I think you can deal with a little bit of advertisement probably in a responsible way. So yes.
If I have the original image and want to prove that it was my image, I can also do image registration.
Yes, if you have the original image. Yes. That's okay, yeah. But there might be a number of reasons why you wouldn't want, either you don't want to keep the image yourself, or you want to be a third party to be able to validate your watermark without having access to the original image. And then, right. If you have the original, you're golden, yeah. Okay. YouTube.
Ha. Als Frau muss man auch.
Als Frau? Gut, ne? Okay, hier ist it's probably an example. Let me make this full screen. So here's a nice demo. Okay, barcode scanner. Okay, everyone knows how a barcode scanner works. And they try to make the case like, yeah, it takes this awful lot of time and time is money, da da da. And wouldn't it be much nicer if you had like your product watermark essentially spread over the whole like box, and then you just swipe it over the scanner and it's gonna find one of those 500 embeddings or so. And you don't need to worry about the exact position of that barcode. And Just a second example. I've seen an actual demo by Digimark, and that is already like 8 years ago or so. 9 years, 7 years, a while ago. Where they took a cell phone and pointed it to newspaper articles, and then there was like from their newspaper, and there were watermarks embedded in all these articles. So the smartphone could essentially recognize these articles, but without doing like an object detection or something. What they were actually recognizing was the embedded watermark. Yeah. And then could, for example, display some additional information or so. Yeah. So that is one of the companies that is actually offering these as products, yeah, to put some recognizable landmarks, machine recognizable landmarks, but not for humans recognizable, into stuff. Yes, please.
But the chip would work like a QR code, and already some.
It works like a QR code, but you wouldn't like to put QR codes over everything.
Yeah, but what I mean is sometimes I want to scan a QR code and I can't do it because my smartphone doesn't recognize the edges or the rotation or the orientation of the QR code. And I mean, it's a black and white picture.
Yeah.
And now the smartphone is doing it with any kind of picture which has been engineered.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It worked well in 2010 already. That's all I can say about it. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'd also expect that there are failure cases here and there, but I tried it myself. So it seemed to work for me. And that was probably even the first time that I used a smartphone at all, because I had a feature phone until 2000 something. So yeah. Okay, but that was just like to illustrate, no? I mean, there are, to my knowledge, there are not many companies in that business, no? I mean, it's a very specialized type of product, obviously. But it is possible to do nice, like it enables nice solutions. Yeah, I have no idea how much money they are actually making with this, but yeah. There's another video on YouTube where they broke the Guinness World Record in speed scanning of products. Okay. Good. Let's talk about security. So, also a long time ago, people from a publishing house in that area here, Middle Franconia, came and said, yeah, they're interested. They would like to have these interactive catalogs to somehow bridge people reading the catalog to their smartphone in order to sell them stuff right away because they can place orders with their smartphones. And what could they do to make that practically happen? And okay, I mean, we're like image processing or computer vision people, so we thought about image processing and computer vision solutions and wrote up a nice like proposal or so and like entered like what we think, what the challenges there are, opportunities. Yeah. And and send it to them. And then they decided. Yeah, and then after that it came to my mind like, yeah, you know, like that is the like the prototypical example for a watermarking application. But then they for some reason decided to dump us in a very unfriendly way and to team up with some other image processing competitors. With our like they took our white paper and carried it to them. And then I decided to not tell them about watermarking. So like, yeah, okay, do your vision stuff, recognition. Good luck with that. But yeah. I mean, after I remembered that Digimark demo, it was so obvious to me. But then, I mean, between these isolated events are years or so, no? So it did not come to my mind when they came and told me about their problem. Okay, anyways. Security. So this topic of security, it's always complicated, yeah? So there are a number of attacks that could be taken into consideration. We just ended in robustness with this desynchronization attack. We can, of course, make this a targeted attack to a watermark. What would be a bad, I mean, the cropping thing, we can sort of fix it probably relatively easily by embedding some landmarks in the picture. What would be a little bit meaner than cropping in order to provoke a desynchronization? Yeah, that's bad, yeah. Like rotate every region a little bit, yeah. Like just 2 degrees or so. No? Yeah, so these are the common, like, e.g. slight local rotation interpolation. And I think that also indicates, okay, what might be potential failure cases to break Digimark's watermark detector. I have no idea how to break it, but I mean, just thinking about the problem, no? Like distortions of that type might certainly pose the more difficult problems to that system, no? Which is not a problem if it's on rigid, like boxes or so, no? Because they don't distort that way, no? Or wobble that way. But yeah. Okay. If you think about security in a broader sense, yeah, there might be all types of stuff happen to your watermark. Like, for example, in some application scenarios, copy attacks might be a problem. So if you have that watermark as, for example, as proof that you bought something, yeah, then a copy attack means you extract
the watermark from one image and copy it. I hope you're in your mind always replacing image by image, video, or audio file. Copy it to another. Yeah. E.g. for proof of ownership. Yeah. Or in the case of the supermarket video for copying price tags or so. Yeah. Okay. So that is one thing. Then there's another family of attacks that is called ambiguity attack. Ambiguity attack. The scenario here is you get a watermarked image, and you're the evil person, yeah? You get a watermarked image, and you create from that watermarked image a watermark and an image which together make perfectly sense. Like that you can claim, okay, so this is my watermark, this is my original image, and they both together result in that watermarked image. So I am the owner of that picture, yeah? So given a watermarked image, create a watermark and an original looking image out of it to claim ownership. So that is an attack that is a little bit more explained in the last of the four papers, an SVD-based watermarking scheme for protecting rightful ownership. So this rightful ownership problem that they are addressing, it's exactly such an ambiguity attack. and then there are other like targeted removal attacks. Like, let me just summarize that. Other targeted removal attacks we come to that in a second. Yeah. Okay, so these are possible like business cases for an attacker or so that he or she would like to achieve, yeah? And then when we talk about security, we always need an attacker model. And that is like the abilities that we grant to an attacker, yeah? So, what is the attacker model? And then you're probably very familiar with that when you heard lectures at the computer security lab, IT security lab. You can scale that from the attacker cannot do anything until like the attacker is super strong, yeah? So attacker cannot do anything. So what is the weakest attacker? Attacker knows nothing. About used algorithms, keys, just knows nothing, yeah? Gets the picture and starts to try an attack. Then a stronger attacker model, for example, to run targeted attacks is that we say, okay, the attacker has multiple watermarked works. So it doesn't necessarily know how it is watermarked, but it has the ability to compare them at a bit level, for example. Or another variant would be to say the attacker knows the algorithms, knows the used algorithms, and a fourth variant that is very dangerous, actually, is that the attacker has a working watermark detector. So this is like an oracle that tells him whether the watermark, the work is watermarked or not. Yeah.
Multiple watermark works. Works means like
images. Like images. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Maybe we should add to these attacks that collusion attack. I'm thinking that, I guess I forgot it here. So my only problem here is, notorious problem, is space. So collusion. Collusion attack. I mean, it somewhat fits under this other targeted removal attacks. So collusion attack attempt to remove watermark by diffing or comparing multiple watermarked works or images, watermarked images. So that, yes?
Does the last attacker then also know the watermark itself if he has a detector?
No.
So he has access to a detector, for example, a website where he can upload an image.
He can upload the picture, yeah.
Does not know the
and it says features. Yes or no.
Okay.
But that is also, it's interesting because that allows things like you can do something like a gradient descent attack, no? And start to search for, should I maybe change the picture like this, no? Let's do some radical changes first, then maybe that sure takes the watermark out, then maybe average between these two extremes, see what the oracle says. So an oracle is pretty good if you have one, no? Yeah, so that goes under this, I should have, sorry, that was, this other targeted was stupid, I should have expanded it right away, so, okay. So, Presence of an oracle. Allows to perform so-called gradient descent attacks or any search strategy. I mean, it doesn't need to be gradient descent, no? On the watermark. So change something ask detector change more or less than last time. Ask the detector. No? We could make an exercise out of this actually.
I was just asking to take a most exact watermark sequence.
No.
Basically
no, then it would be. Yeah.
Right?
Okay, actually, it depends on the way how the watermark is embedded. If it's an invertible embedding, it's immediately over. No? Let me think a little bit more about non-invertible embeddings. But no, it's a yes-no. It's a yes-no machine, this thing. No? And you have to do the work in between. But still, it gives you a lot of power already. No? Where have we our right? If the attacker knows the used algorithm, no, then you need to secure your watermark somehow with a cryptographic key or so, because otherwise you're just like it can be readily like the payload, the information, like customer ID or so, can be readily obtained, no? So that. A countermeasure to attackers who know the algorithm is to always cryptographically secure, so encrypt essentially, yeah? Encrypt your payload, no? But of course, I mean, like very same thing like in cryptography or so, you wouldn't trust in security that is based on the fact that the attacker does not know what algorithm you're using. No? So so of course you want to publish your algorithm, let experts validate that method, no? Okay, it looks secure to them. No? And then still be able to use it. And for that concept, you always need something like keys. Yeah, I mean, you generate your watermark sequence yourself. No, and then depending on how you perform your embedding, maybe you encrypt your payload, and you're good. Yeah, and then again, also in the encryption, essentially what you do is you store your key. No, and that is also same thing like with the watermark. Sequence creation. Okay, so these are a number of aspects on the security. So security essentially is determined by what would we like to do, and what capabilities do we have from the perspective of an attacker. I did not say how to perform this ambiguity attack. But essentially the idea is, or the copy attack, it's actually very similar. So the idea is this, you filter out the noise of the image and you say, okay, that is your watermark information. Yeah. The only problem is your noise may contain also some structure of the picture. Yeah, like if you filter out the high frequencies, you get the silhouettes of your object in the picture. So that means you have to filter a little bit more to suppress them. And then you take this residual noise component and add it or introduce it to another picture. Yeah. So that is that copy attack essentially. And you can do your whole image processing portfolio to make that nice. And that ambiguity attack then additionally, if you have an invertible watermarking scheme, says, okay, now if I filter out that noise component from an image, I declare this to be my watermark. It has to look like it may not contain any artifacts from the edges or so, but then you say, okay, that's my watermark. It correlates very nicely with that image. So if it comes to a watermark validation, it's great. And then you use the fact that the watermarking scheme is invertible to invert the watermarking function to create an original image that does not contain your watermark. Is that clear? So typically you have an embedding function. You have something like embed into the image some watermark, and this gives you some watermarked image I star or so. Yeah? Okay. Now, if this function is invertible, it means that you can sort of hallucinate from I star and the watermark an unwatermarked image I. Yeah, like unwatermarked. And then you go to a judge and you say, oh, actually, there's one step missing. Can we squeeze something in here? So we hallucinate from I star a watermark W star. So these are, for example, the high frequencies. Yeah, and then we hallucinate from I star and this watermark star an original image I tilde with the property that embed of I tilde and watermark star leads to I star. Yeah? So this means we can go to a judge. We say, okay, I have that picture on the web like for years, and here's my secret watermark. Watermark star, and here's my secret original I tilde. And I can show I watermarked it because I use my embedding and I obtain that image that has been on the web for ages. So it's my picture. Yeah. And that is that ambiguity attack. Yeah. Which can make to work if that embedding function is invertible. Because what we do in this hallucination step here is that we invert the embedding. Yeah. So we could also write here embed to the power of -1 or so, if that is more helpful. Maybe. Yeah, that would be that function here. Okay. Now the interesting thing is this attack is not entirely for free. Because a judge could say that all makes sense. But if you use that watermarking algorithm, then isn't it reasonable to assume that this watermark star was a uniformly distributed random sequence? Yeah, just like, yeah, sure. No, that's always the way how we embed stuff. No, so that means that when you are inventing that watermark WM star, you have to make sure that it looks statistically plausible. Yeah, because otherwise, the story doesn't work. No. Yes.
It has to be invertible. But I only claim that I own I2 as the original.
Yes.
So my inversion can be crappy as hell, as long as there's no other kind of watermark detectable in I2. I mean, all I have to do is make a...
Yeah, okay.
That could be without any kind of watermark, and then I have to add my watermark star and say my algorithm is crappy as shit.
Yeah.
But I get the I star that's public on the internet, and that proves that it's mine. So I would assume that the mathematical correctness. I don't have to be mathematically correct because I'm already doing a pottery. And at least the guy I'm going to sue will provide with the original I and the original watermark.
Okay.
I mean, I have to be smarter than him. So.
Right. So you have to make a claim. Yeah. You have to make a claim here. As an attacker, you have to say specifically, okay, you know, the way I'm embedding watermarks is with this algorithm 1 from exercise 1, because that was my first implementation, so I'm attached to it. Yeah, okay, and that I tilde that you present must work with that algorithm that you claim that you used. Yeah, so you can only, okay, yeah. So that means you can only, you're right. But that means you can only claim that you used invertible algorithms. Because only for invertible algorithms, you can find for a watermark star a matching I tilde such that they both together can be used in that algorithm. Now, when someone else comes and says, like, yeah, no, this is all made up, yeah? Because I also embedded a watermark here, and I actually used a not invertible algorithm, so I cannot be the bad guy here. Then the guy with the invertible algorithm gets in complications, no? So, yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, okay, that are these like security type of questions, yeah? As you will see in these papers. All of these points are in one way or another more or less addressed. Yeah. So these the points that we saw today and last week, yeah, these are the recurring topics that this whole watermark research is about. Yeah. And of course, that is also what determines, okay, like how innovative is a work, or how generally applicable, and so on. No, is closely tied to to what degree these questions are addressed. No, so when you have a look at these papers, yeah. And as I said, I don't want you to read them all like line by line or so, because it's a lot of text. Yeah. But of course you're invited to if you like, but I'm not expecting that. Yeah. But but just when you scan through them, yeah, you will find these concepts again and again, yeah, and I would like you to try to identify them, or at least a reasonable number, yeah. So, and these are what I tried to write down in terms of questions on that PDF that I additionally put on Studan, So how are they trying to achieve robustness? What security questions are they addressing, if any? And then if they are talking about it, are they really doing something about it, or are they just mentioning it for the sake of having mentioned, oh, there's a problem in that that is worth to talk about or so, and then you see, oh, nothing happens or so, yeah? So whatever you're able to spot here, it's gonna be an interesting find. And that is why I really would like you guys to have a look at this, and we can, I want to discuss this next time, because I won't postpone it for another week, certainly. sorry, so no blames or hard feelings or so towards anyone, but so last opportunity last week, before we talk about it, okay? I think it's a really great exercise. Now, how should we proceed? Before you guys came, we said like, yeah, maybe we can talk about that DCT paper already and skip the other three papers for later. But I'm not sure how much sense it makes, or if we just should call it a day and start next week right away with these papers. I don't know. Any opinion?